Hey everyone, Beyond the Baseline is brought to you by the SeatGeek app. The easiest way to find a great deal, pay for your ticket, get to your seat. Download the SeatGeek app, enter our code BEYOND for $20 off your first purchase. We're also sponsored by FanDuel, the leader in one-week fantasy football with more winners, more payouts than any other site. Enter the promo code BEYOND at FanDuel.com for a bonus match of up to $200. One of the great sort of verities of jazz is the rests count as much as the notes, and if you're really a connoisseur, you appreciate the pauses as well as the notes being played. Is there anything analogous to that in tennis?
You are absolutely right. One of the things you learn as an older and more experienced musician is that you don't have to drive the bus all the time. You don't have to play every note. You don't have to cram everything in. And I think I hear you guys talk a lot about, oh, it's really unfortunate that that person is rushing, that they need to slow down. And it's the same thing with young jazz musicians. They're in a hurry to get everything out, and they need to kind of lay back a little bit.
Everyone, John Wertheim here, this week's Sports Illustrated Tennis Podcast. Our guest this week is Fred Hirsch, 8-time Grammy-nominated jazz pianist. Vanity Fair says he's the most arrestingly innovative pianist in jazz in the last decade. He has a new solo CD out. He is also a tennis fan, and that's where we'll begin. Fred, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So I gave you a little heads up. You know where I'm going with this. You are an accomplished jazz musician. I feel like jazz and improvisation and innovation are these terms that we bandy about somewhat cavalierly in tennis, and I thought it would be cool if we talked to an actual jazz musician who could talk about the role of improvisation in tennis. And with that broad question, I invite you to riff.
All right. I also have been teaching young pianists or professional pianists for many, many, many years. And I've taken my interest in tennis and not only the improvisatory aspect of tennis, but the body mechanics of tennis kind of into the teaching studio. Many pianists start with their focus on the fingers and making the fingers strong and doing all these exercises to make the fingers more independent. I feel that the piano as a percussion instrument, the sound kind of comes from your body and it goes through your fingertip into the piano, much in the way that a tennis player, their whole body and their footwork and everything has to be totally lined up so that they can make that perfect shot or they can make that improvisatory shot. And we've all seen many tennis matches, notably the recent Serena upset, where you could just tell that it was not going to go her way just by her footwork. And I also love the more improvisatory tennis players, the McEnroes, the Federers, who kind of make up shots that are not in the book in the heat of the moment. And that's because their technique and their whole body is so aligned to produce that perfect shot. It's not from the wrist, it's not from the arm, it's not from the shoulder. It's that racket is the end point of the whole affair. And another thing that relates jazz and tennis is when I'm playing a solo and I'm improvising, I want to be in that kind of flow state where I don't want to think too far ahead because then I'm going to figuratively drop the ball, and I don't want to dwell on what I just did if I maybe didn't like it so much, because then I'm going to be distracted. And tennis players, I always hear, you know, the great ones, they just play the point. And if they maybe had a bad patch, you know, they haven't lost the match. If I have a bad patch in a solo, it doesn't mean it's not going to be successful. Or one tune in a set might not be of the caliber of the other ones, but it doesn't mean that the whole set is a wash. So there's so many areas that jazz and tennis overlap.
Wait, you know, I'll ask you about sort of technique and the technical aspect in a second. But let's keep going on that point. I mean, you have no scoreboard. You have no first 1-6 games. You have this, you know, you have some sense of probably of what you want to do, but you have this improvisational component too. What makes for a successful set? I mean, what at the end of the day, you're not looking at the scoreboard and saying, I won 6 games in each set. For you, with your sets, what defines success?
Well, I think it's, you know, for me, a set of music is like planning a really great menu. And, you know, if you do too many tunes that are similar in their language or in their vibe or in their key or in their tempo, you know, then it's like, you know, eating a plate of food that has, you know, pasta, mashed potatoes and rice. You know, I think variety, keeping my interest and the interest of the musicians I'm playing over, playing with, making an emotional connection to what we play, and then planning the set. And a lot of times my sets are spontaneously planned. I know the first couple of tunes, and then I kind of see how I feel. And I think a good set of music is a kind of a journey. It kind of takes you somewhere, much like in the days of people my age, I'm going to be 60 in a couple of weeks. We sat down, and if we wanted to listen to music, we had to sit with an LP on a stereo, on a sofa in front of a stereo. We couldn't listen while we were jogging or doing email or anything else. And so we developed the idea that the sequence of a side of a record really mattered. And then when CDs came along, you had an opportunity to tell a slightly longer story, maybe a 60-minute continuous story instead of a side A and side B. So I take a lot of care in when I put a CD together, taking the audience on some kind of journey, having enough variety, and that each piece within itself is successful, but that cumulatively the listener is, you know, left with a really great impression.
It's funny because I've heard tennis players describe a match the same way, that you go out there and you're fresh and you sort of strap in and you're not going to, you know, you have no idea, is this going to be 45 minutes? Is this going to be 3 hours? Are there going to be ups and downs? Is it going to be straightforward? I've heard multiple tennis players use the word journey too, but it strikes me from an improvisation standpoint, the big difference as I see it is that there's someone on the other side of the net in tennis. I mean, you're at some level dependent on the ball you're being fed as opposed to a jazz musician. Do you think this sort of the existence of an opponent, what does that do for creativity and for improvisation? Does it accentuate it or blunt it that there's someone on the other side giving you a ball to hit?
Well, that's why I play with the bass player and drummer that I've been playing with for years now. That's why I like to play every year at the Jazz Standard Club here in New York in May for 10 years running. I every night invite a different partner to play duo with me, people I've never played with before. It's like meeting somebody at a tournament for the first time. We just see what happens. Sometimes we're reading music. Sometimes we're just playing tunes we know. But there is definitely a give and take. And I don't expect my bass player and drummer in my trio to be subservient. If they have an idea, they throw it at me. And I have to be sometimes willing to say, oh, I hadn't thought of that, but let's try that. I want them to feel involved, certainly supportive, but sometimes they throw me a curveball or a shot that I didn't expect. And that's part of jazz. You know, you can't really have jazz without some danger. And if it becomes too predictable and formulaic, then it's really not interesting. And we've all seen tennis matches that can become kind of not that interesting when you have two opponents of the kind of same style, two baseliners, two grinders. You know, it's not really as interesting as when you have, you know, two players of maybe opposite styles and temperaments. In the old day, you had a baseliner versus serve and volleyer. So it was really a lot kind of those matchups were always kind of more interesting. It's the same thing with jazz. Sometimes people will say, wow, Fred's playing with this guy. I got to check that out. That's really unusual. I wouldn't think that they would have much in common. And so, yes, definitely. I like an opponent, if you will. And I like, you know, being taken out of my comfort zone. And that's how I get better.
It's funny you mentioned Serena, and I think when people see that a tennis player has lost, there's this sort of reflexive, oh, they got wild and they couldn't control the ball. And what I find is that more often than not, it's the opposite. They play tentatively, they play passively, they stop improvising, they stop taking risks. I mean, you look at Rafael Nadal's play this year, and it's not that he has this welter of unforced errors, it's that he's not taking the risks and not improvising as he once did. Do you sense that as a fan watching, and do you have the same, you know, that does an off-night performing cause you to improvise more cautiously?
Are you talking about tennis or jazz?
Well, both. I mean, do you sense that when you're watching tennis, and then as a performer in jazz, yeah, when you have an off night, does that sort of change your almost your risk reward ratio?
You know, I mean, I think there are nights maybe that are not great where you're either trying too hard or you've maybe had an idea of what's going to happen and that's not what happened and you got kind of attached to it. And, you know, as we all know, attachment leads more often to disappointment than anything else. You know, so, I mean, I've seen cases in tennis matches where somebody walks onto the court and they feel like, well, their ranking is a bazillion times higher than their opponent. They deserve to win. And then they realize 4 or 5 games in, they're going to have a match on their hands.
With the possible exception of jazz, is there anything more American than watching sports on TV? I don't think so. But if you've been itching to get out to a game or concert in person, do it with the SeatGeek app. Why, you ask? Because they're giving our listeners $20 when you use the code BEYOND. That's right, a $20 check with your name on it, no catch. Here's how it works. Download the SeatGeek app on your iPhone or Android. It's free, takes less than a minute. Then search for your event of choice, find the deal you want, enter our code, and when you complete the purchase, SeatGeek will send you a $20 check to your house. It's that easy. You want to go watch tennis, you want to go watch Fred Hirsch in concert, you can do that using the SeatGeek app. It pulls in ticket options from hundreds of sellers online and shows you the best deal. It also has this cool feature called Deal Score that ranks every ticket on the market in terms of value, plots the best deal with a color-coded map. It makes it easy to crack the code on the best values. Again, here's how you download this great offer. Download the app, enter the promo code BEYOND. SeatGeek will then send you a $20 check. Once you've made your first SeatGeek purchase, it's that easy. Go to SeatGeek app, enter the code BEYOND, save $20. Tennis season is winding down. So is baseball season. We're in the postseason, in fact, and it is the best time of year for Seamheads. SI has the perfect show to keep you up to date with playoff baseball. Every week, it's The Strike Zone. SI's baseball podcast has the dynamic duo of Ted Keith and Steve Cannella. They take you inside the numbers of America's pastime. Search for The Strike Zone on iTunes or find it at si.com/podcasts. So in tennis, there's this unwritten civic ordinance that whenever conversation touches on artistry and creativity, we must invoke Roger Federer's name. Am I correct in making the assumption he's a player from an artistic standpoint that you enjoy watching?
Yeah, I really enjoy watching him. I mean, you know, just the amazing level of tennis smarts that he has, the depth in his game, not just the serve, which is still at 34 years old, remarkable and fairly hard to read. Maybe it's not the fastest or hardest, but he doesn't lose his serve often. I love that he has that quality that the great tennis players have, in my experience, going back to, you know, the wooden era, wooden racket era that I used to love watching the older players. You know, he's kind of one with the ball. You know, you really feel like, you know, he's really completely involved in making that shot. And when he comes up with these shots that, as I said, are not in the playbook, that even he, maybe if you asked him to practice that shot, wouldn't be able to do it. But at an inspired moment, you know, late in a third set, he's going to come up with it because he just has that extra degree of talent and athleticism and natural ability and coordination. It's really a beautiful thing to watch.
What other players do you enjoy watching?
What other players do I enjoy watching? Certainly when Serena Williams is on, there's kind of, it's sort of a remarkable and beautiful thing. Lately, I've been, just this past summer, I've been enjoying watching Venus, you know, who is no less remarkable than her sister. I have grudgingly come to accept Djokovic as the total badass that he is. How he can turn offense to defense and defense to offense, and his uncanny ability to move and stretch. He's like kind of Gumby out there. I was never a huge Nadal fan. I found it a little too brutal. And, like every shot, you know, seemed to be the last shot he was going to make. And that, you know, that kind of got a little tiresome. But I can, you know, I can enjoy seeing really lots of players, you know, during a major, you know, you turn on the television at night and the draw might say you're probably going to see this person and that person, but somebody got knocked out in the first round and you see somebody you haven't seen and they've got nothing to lose and they're swinging for the fences and they've got somebody with a big name, you know, on their heels. And that's really exciting to see some of the younger players break through. I mean, you know, we've had the big three or the big four in the men's game, and we've had the domination of Serena, but sooner or later that's going to end. And it's interesting to watch the younger or mid-career players and think who might step up and get a major or more than one major going forward.
I think one of the great, I don't want to say cliche, but one of these sort of verities of jazz is the rests count as much as the notes, and the rests are these notes of silence. And if you're really a connoisseur, you appreciate the pauses as well as the notes being played. Is there anything analogous to that in tennis when you watch?
Huh, that's a very interesting perspective. You are absolutely right. I think, you know, one of the things you learn as an older and more experienced musician is that you don't have to drive the bus all the time. You don't have to play every note. You don't have to cram everything in. You can play a phrase, kind of enjoy it, and see where it wants to go without pushing things and without crowding things. And I think, you know, that's why, you know, the older experienced players, 9 times out of 10 in the major finals, you know, we always say, oh, you know, this young person or this person who is a surprised finalist hasn't had that experience yet. And I think, you know, there's the rest of, okay, we finished the point, now we're going to serve. And I think I hear you guys talk a lot about, oh, it's really unfortunate that person is rushing his or her serve, that they need to slow down. And it's the same thing with young jazz musicians. They're in a hurry to get everything out, and they need to kind of lay back a little bit and also to listen to the other people around them. And I think, yes, you do have that rest between, and that's a chance to gather yourself, and you can adjust that tempo of your serving speed, maybe, between points. And I think if I was a tennis player, I would want to find that place where I'm thinking about the next point, but I'm not thinking about it too much, and where I feel physically rested but not, you know, losing my concentration. I think that's just different for every person.
I got a random one for you. This conversation, I should say, springs out. We had a very pleasant lunch maybe a week ago or so. We were talking tennis, and it occurred to me that we sort of went back interchangeably, men and women, and Venus and Serena, and Federer and Nadal, and Justine Henin and Capriati, and Mary Jo Fernandez. What's kind of the gender breakdown in jazz?
Well, that's an interesting point. I think, you know, if we're talking about non-vocalists, if we're talking about instrumentalists, right. I mean, certainly there have been some, you know, notable women in the, you know, in the early mid part of last century who stepped up, mostly piano players, Mary Lou Williams, Mary McPartland, people like that. It's only in the last maybe 30, 40 years that we're hearing women playing horns, brass, saxophones, with drums, with a lot of authority and substance. I think there's been a lot made of, jazz being a kind of a boys' club. And I know that there's some, brouhaha in the tennis world about, okay, the women are getting equal prize money, but they're not playing five sets in the majors. And I think the women's game, is often as entertaining as the men's game. And I think right now in jazz, we're seeing in the last 30 or so years with the explosion in jazz education, we're seeing, more and more women saying, well, I want to play the alto saxophone, or I want to play the trombone or the trumpet or the drums or the bass. And I think now that it's, I guess the equivalent in tennis would be the internationalization of the sport, where you have, people from all over the world. It's not just, America and Australia and France anymore and Great Britain. There's so many players from Eastern Europe and Asia and South America. It's become accessible to everybody. So you've got a more diverse pool of talent. And I would say the same with jazz.
Hey, everyone, we take a break from tennis and jazz to ask this penetrating question. How's your fantasy football team doing? If that question inspires shame or self-loathing, have no fear. You don't need to tolerate a bad lineup or an injured player any longer. Start fresh today with FanDuel and do it with up to $200 in bonus cash when you use our code BEYOND. Unless you've been living under a rock somewhere, you probably heard of FanDuel. If you ever wanted to try it but didn't really know how, here's what it's all about. FanDuel's the leader in one-week fantasy football. They pay out over $75 million a week this football season. We all love fantasy football. Sometimes we get lousy teams. FanDuel does away with the frustration because you can draft a team anytime, drop in and out of tournaments for weekly cash prizes. Entry fees start at just $1. Over 1 million players have won money playing fantasy sports on FanDuel. Now it's your turn. How do you do it? Easy. Go to FanDuel.com, click on the microphone in the upper right-hand corner, use the code BEYOND, and sign up now. Again, use the code BEYOND, and you'll get a bonus of up to $200. This offer is good only for the first 50 people that use the code BEYOND. So do it today. Don't get left out. FanDuel.com. Every day is a new season. Try it out today. All right, now back to Fred Hirsch talking about the parallels between jazz and tennis.
I was going to ask you about the internationalization too, but I'm curious. I mean, you've spoken so thoughtfully and passionately about these parallels between jazz and tennis. Do you see this with other sports? Or is tennis special, or could we be having this conversation about golf and basketball and the football game on Monday night?
I relate to tennis because I think the mental game is so important. The mental game in music is so important. Whether you're playing classical music or where you know a piece really well, but the ideal is to make you and the audience feel like they're hearing it for the first time, to keep it fresh. Jazz, where you're not really quite sure you know what's going to happen, but you want it to sound inevitable in some sort of way. I think the physicality of playing the piano from your lower body through your arms and fingers into the piano is very much like, it's a little bit radical to people who have developed very finger-based technique. So, balance and finding the sound in the piano is something that I've spent a lot of time with. Maybe it's one of my signature things about my playing is the actual sound I get. It's just like, the great ones, they have a motion on their serve that's distinctive, or they have a way that they play a certain stroke that's kind of unique and personal that works for them. And sometimes it looks very strange, like Marianne Bartoli, or sometimes it looks really smooth and wonderful, like like Serena's serve. You just never know.
I'm envisioning Marion Bartoli warming up before performing a concert in a jazz studio. But do you have the same type of range in jazz that you have in tennis stylistically? Whereas, Marion Bartoli is a good example. I mean, two players on the side of the net can almost look like they're playing different sports sometimes. Do you have that as well?
Absolutely. I mean, there's so, jazz is such a, it's like, I might say to you jazz and you might think of Miles Davis, the Thelonious Monk, or Charles Mingus, and some other people would think of jazz as this kind of original music composed by young musicians in all kinds of odd time signatures with very complex mathematical bass. Some people, for them, jazz is Dave Brubeck and big bands. It's like you say, classical music. Well, are you talking about, Schoenberg? Are you talking about Beethoven? Are you talking about Bach or somebody writing now? It's a big world that jazz encompasses now. It's not, this is jazz, this is not jazz. I mean, jazz is, well, they say jazz and baseball are America's gift to the world in terms of really unique things that kind of happened here. And maybe some people would debate that because of the connection with, rugby or cricket or something else. But, pretty much jazz and baseball are kind of American contributions to world culture. And the definition is really pretty broad.
And finally, I'm curious. I mean, one question I ponder in tennis quite a bit, but I also suspect you ponder as well, is sort of where's the art going? So what's tennis going to look like in X years? And part of it is equipment, and part of it is demographics, and part of it is sort of its space in the sportscape. I wonder if you have the same sorts of conversations. What's jazz going to sound like in X years, or is that not sort of organic to the discussion?
Well, in my lifetime of playing jazz for 40 years as a professional, it's gone from, for me, playing music on bandstands where nobody's looking at anything, and you just had to know tunes and swing, and it was kind of simple, and to a lot of complexity. I think tennis, once we got out of the wooden racket era, the equipment has changed. Players are much, much bigger, more conditioning, more training, but they're also flying around all over the world. They'll be playing in Singapore and then they'll be playing in São Paulo. I mean, it's kind of crazy what they put their bodies through at this elite level. I think one good thing that I think tennis should do is come up with a better system of making sure that players don't delay between points. I think time violation warnings are pretty capricious and left up to the umpire, really. And a lot of people kind of push that envelope, and it really does slow the game down. I think that's something that could be maybe legislated a little bit. I mean, people kind of were a little confused at the beginning by Hawkeye, but now, thank God we have it. And, the tiebreak was an innovation too that really, really helped the sport. And frankly, I think tiebreaks should be final sets of all tournaments, should be a tiebreak. There should be an endpoint. We shouldn't have Isner Mahut. We shouldn't have 16-14 in the fifth. These people have already been out there four or 5 hours. Like, let's have an endpoint. And I think it'd be more exciting for the fans.
All right, that's great. Speaking of endpoints, this is a little
thanks,
different.
Yeah, John, I appreciate it.
No, I think, this is what we're trying to do here. All sorts of perspectives, and I'm glad you had some time. You're going to be performing, I want to get this out, you're going to be performing at the Village Vanguard here in New York October 20th to 25th, is that right?
October 20th to 25th, 20 to 25.
Come here, Fred Hirsch, big tennis fan. Thanks again. We'll do it again.
All right, thanks, John.
That was great. I'm going to have you take us out with some Fred Hirsch music.
All right, we'll see you soon.